From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S.-Israeli division in the Iran nuclear debate.
A fair number of leading Israeli security analysts tend to agree with the Obama administration and other international leaders more than they do with their prime ministry.
Brutality is reported eroding ISIS financing. Climate change is being called a factor in two disasters, and a report warns that nearly 30 countries are vulnerable to Ebola-like epidemics. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a controversial move, has addressed a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, warning that a pending comprehensive nuclear agreement between a U.S.-led coalition and Iran could threaten the survival of the Jewish state.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, spews the oldest hatred of anti-Semitism with the newest technology. He tweets that Israel must be annihilated. He tweets. You know, in Iran, there isn't exactly free internet. But he tweets in English that Israel must be destroyed. For those who believe that Iran threatens the Jewish state, but not the Jewish people, listen to Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, Iran's chief terrorist proxy. He said, "If all the Jews gather in Israel, it will save us the trouble of chasing them down around the world." But Iran's regime is not merely a Jewish problem, any more than the Nazi regime was merely a Jewish problem. The 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis were but a fraction of the 60 million people killed in World War II. So too, Iran's regime poses a grave threat not only to Israel, but also to the peace of the entire world. To understand just how dangerous Iran would be with nuclear weapons, we must fully understand the nature of the regime. The people of Iran are very talented people. They're heirs to one of the world's great civilizations. But in 1979, they were hijacked by religious zealots who imposed on them immediately a dark and brutal dictatorship. That year, the zealots drafted a constitution, a new one for Iran. It directed the Revolutionary Guards not only to protect Iran's borders, but also to fulfill the ideological mission of jihad. The regime's founder, Ayatollah Khomeini, exhorted his followers to export the revolution throughout the world. I'm standing here in Washington, D.C., and the difference is so stark. America's founding document promises life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Iran's founding document pledges death, tyranny, and the pursuit of jihad. And as states are collapsing across the Middle East, Iran is charging into the void to do just that. Iran's goons in Gaza, its lackeys in Lebanon, its revolutionary guards on the Golan Heights are clutching Israel with three tentacles of terror. Backed by Iran, Assad is slaughtering Syrians. Backed by Iran, Shiite militias are rampaging through Iraq. Backed by Iran, Houthis are seizing control of Yemen, threatening the strategic straits at the mouth of the Red Sea. Along with the Straits of Hormuz, that would give Iran a second choke point on the world's oil supply. Just last week, near Hormuz, Iran carried out a military exercise, blowing up a mock U.S. aircraft carrier. That's just last week, while they're having nuclear talks with the United States.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressing a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress today. He was invited by House Speaker John Boehner, a Republican, without consulting the Democratic White House, a move seen as a break from protocol. President Obama, in a Reuters interview Monday, asked the negotiations with Iran be allowed to play out. He expressed confidence an agreement would most likely prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Since an interim agreement was reached in November 2013, the United States, its coalition partners, and Iran have been working to reach an agreement on Iran's uranium enrichment levels that addresses Western concerns that Iran has nuclear weapons ambitions. Iran, in return, is seeking relief from international sanctions. They have been trying to reach a framework agreement by the end of March. The two sides hope to have a final agreement by the end of June. Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Obama administration appears to enjoy wide international support for his negotiating effort.
Clearly, it is very much in the interest of the United States, as well as the international community, to try to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. So this idea that somehow Israeli Prime Minister has particular insights, that the broad coalition negotiators in the Iran talks somehow have missed out on, seems a little far-fetched, especially since there are reports in the Israeli media that a fair number of leading Israeli security analysts tend to agree with the Obama administration and other international leaders more than they do with their prime minister.
What do you make of Mr. Obama's revelation of at least a 10-year freeze on nuclear development?
Clearly, given how long and drawn out and difficult the negotiations have been to even get to this point, clearly they do not want anything that's of a shorter term than this. Also, I think there is hope within the international community that the reform movement in Iran, which is growing, especially with a younger generation that is desiring a closer cooperation with the West and an end to Iran's international isolation, will be in a stronger place politically 10 years from now, so that a stronger agreement can be reached, and Iran will not be seen as quite the pariah and potential threat that it is today.
The French press agency says Israel believes an agreement as short as 10 or 20 years would mean Iran would arrive at the threshold of being a nuclear weapons power in virtually the same political environment as today.
Their hopes, I think, are less than most of the international community, and I would argue most Iranians. In any case, even if they did break out of the agreement 10 years from now, the provisions regarding inspections and monitoring are such that it would take at minimum a year, even with a full throttle effort, for Iran to actually develop a nuclear weapon. So there appears to be sufficient safeguards in place, even in the worst-case scenario. But a lot of what will determine whether Iran goes in the direction of wanting a nuclear deterrent will depend a lot on the perceived threats against it. Though Iran, of course, is an authoritarian regime under an Islamist rule, what gives them power in these kinds of international disputes is their ability to play on the Iranian strong sense of nationalism and their ability to manipulate the fears that Iran has, given the history of foreign intervention in that country. So it would seem that if their goal is to encourage the ascendancy of more moderate elements within Iran, certainly going a diplomatic path rather than sanctions and war would be the way to go.
Zuna says, given Iran's advances in missile technology that coincide with its nuclear program, there are elements within Iran who would like to see it develop a nuclear deterrent capability. However, he says developing nuclear weapons would actually make it less secure and give its enemies an excuse to threaten war. Zuna says this would serve as an incentive for Tehran to pursue a nuclear agreement. The top U.S. intelligence official says the Islamic State's penchant for publicizing beheadings and other brutal acts is hurting the terror group's bottom line. VOA national security reporter Jeff Selden reports.
Slowly but surely, U.S. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper says the Islamic State's proving to be its own worst enemy.
These brutalities, publicized brutalities by ISIL, beheadings and immolations and the like, have really had a galvanizing effect even in the Mideast.
Clapper, speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, says the strongest evidence comes from donations, which he says have seen a big decline.
The amount of donations that ISIL got was a very, very less than 1% of their total revenue from last year.
Clapper says some of the decline is also due to increased oversight from governments across the Middle East, sometimes with U.S. help. Just last month, a top U.S. Treasury official said Washington had been having some important successes in denying the Islamic State access to revenue and in limiting its ability to use money it did have. But donations are just one way the Islamic State gets its money, with robbery and extortion, oil sales, and ransoms all generating more revenue. Clapper also warns stifling the Islamic State's finances will not be enough, and that the U.S. is still struggling to counter the group's narrative, given America's general lack of popularity in parts of the Muslim world.
I think in the end, our ability to do that and to really influence change in attitudes and change in worldview is only going to come about when the people there themselves do that.
Clapper also noted difficulties encountering the Islamic State in Syria, which he said is compounded by the fact that, unlike with Iraq, the U.S. is actually not there. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Mourners today paid respects to Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, the fierce Moscow critic who was gunned down just steps away from the Kremlin last week. Friends and family carrying red flowers shuffled by the open casket of the 55-year-old Nemtsov, whose body was lying in state at the Andrei Sakharov Right Center in Moscow. President Vladimir Putin has promised a full investigation into the murder, which many opposition activists said was reprisal for Nemtsov's criticism of Moscow. We asked VOA senior and former Moscow correspondent Andrei Dineshnara what effect the murder has on the Russian political scene.
Well, the key thing is, what will it do to the opposition? And no one really knows, because he was definitely one of the leaders. And the question is whether it will galvanize the opposition, or whether they will just say, well, we're going to just have a new crackdown and things will continue the way they are. That is the key question. But one has to remember that Vladimir Putin's popularity rate is sky high right now. After the whole issue in Crimea and Ukraine, the Russian people, or some of them, believe that Russia is once again a great power. It has proved itself. But as to what the opposition will do, I just don't know.
Well, what is the public's general reaction to this murder?
Well, it was stunning. I mean, to have somebody gunned down in the middle of the night on a very well-known bridge, and somebody of the stature of Boris Nemtsov, even if you're not a member of the opposition, you must be thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Could this actually bring down Putin? Could it actually tarnish him to the point where he'll have to step aside?
I don't think so, because, again, like I said earlier, his popularity rate is very, very high. And but what will quote unquote bring him down? I don't know. He has put together a very strong fisted, if you will, government that really does not like any kind of opposition. And if you were an opposition leader such as Garry Kasparov, the former world chess champion, or the blogger Alexander Navalny, you'd be thinking about what to do next, given the fact that somebody like Nemtsov was gunned down. Now, one has to say that there are no direct links to the Kremlin, but over the years there have been major opposition leaders who have been assassinated and who may or may not have been ordered by the Kremlin. But that's still something to be decided.
VOA senior and former Moscow correspondent Andrei Dineshnara here in our Washington studios. Climate change helped set off a chain of events that likely led to the Syrian civil war, according to a new study. Another report in the same journal says the record-breaking drought crippling the most populous and most productive state in the U.S. bears the same hallmark of climate change. The two point to the possibility of clear and present dangers from a threat often considered far in the future. VOA's Steve Barragona has details.
From 2007 to 2010, Syria was devastated by the worst drought in the country's recorded history. Climatologist and lead study author Colin Kelly says crops failed and livestock died, driving an estimated 1.5 million people from their homes.
And these people picked up their families and en masse migrated to the urban areas to try and survive. They weren't thinking about the future. They were thinking about the present.
Kelly says they fled to cities already overburdened by as many as 1.5 million refugees from the Iraq War. Shantytowns sprung up that were breeding grounds of discontent that erupted in 2011. In the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Kelly and colleagues write that the drought that pushed the cities over the edge was made more likely by climate change. The group found that the warming and drying trend the region has experienced since the mid-20th century fits well with what models predict from increased greenhouse gases.
When you include the long-term trend, that you were 2 to 3 times more likely to have multi-year droughts that were as severe as the most recent one.
But, he adds, it was not just the drought that did it.
We're not saying that global warming or climate change triggered or caused the uprising in Syria. What we are saying is that it basically exacerbated the drought that occurred, made it more severe, the most severe in the observed record, and that this set about a chain of events that ultimately led to the uprising.
Meanwhile, another study in the journal suggests climate change has made more likely the kind of crippling drought facing the U.S. state of California. 1 in 8 Americans lives in California. The state produces 12% of the nation's GDP and more than 10% of its farm income. Noah Diffenbaugh is a Stanford University climate scientist. He says California has wet years and dry years.
We do know from looking at the historical record that low precipitation years have been much more likely, greater than 2 times as likely, to produce severe drought if they co-occur with warm conditions. And what we've found in California is that there's been a very clear long-term warming.
In new research, he and his colleagues say that's made a drought like the current one more probable.
That increase in probability doesn't occur without the human contribution of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
And in both California and Syria, the studies say the future looks to be warmer and drier still. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
A new report warns that nearly 30 countries are highly vulnerable to an Ebola-like epidemic. Save the Children says those countries have even weaker health care systems than Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone had before the outbreak. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Save the Children report is entitled Wake Up Call, Lessons from Ebola for the World's Health Systems. Brendan Cox is the organization's director of policy and advocacy.
What we hope is that from all of the horror, the pain and the suffering that's come as a result of the Ebola crisis, that some good will come of it, that we will learn some of the lessons. And so, as the name of the report says, we hope it will be a wake-up call to the international community. What that means is that we need to get much better at not just responding to crises like Ebola, but getting out ahead of them.
He says countries with weak healthcare systems are prime areas for disease outbreaks.
When you allow a country like Liberia with one healthcare worker per 4,000 people, which compares to the UK of 1 per 80, for example, it should be of no surprise that those countries are susceptible to outbreaks like this, and also that they can incubate diseases like this that can also spread around the planet.
The Save the Children report lists 28 countries as highly vulnerable to West Africa Ebola-size epidemics.
Most of them are in Africa, but they range from Haiti to Afghanistan, really right around the world, but obviously focused on those poorest countries. And what that says is that far from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea being the exception, far from them being strange individual cases, in fact, there's a whole set of countries, some with much bigger population sizes, that could be in danger of these sorts of diseases.
Cox says the threat is not just from Ebola. He says two new zoonotic diseases, diseases that are transmitted from animals to humans, emerge every year. It's estimated donors have committed $4.3 billion to fight Ebola in West Africa. Save the Children says that's nearly 3 times the annual cost of investing in building a universal health service in all 3 affected countries.
Unless we learn that old adage that prevention is better than cure, we're going to be spending a hell of a lot of money that we didn't need to. And most importantly, a lot more human suffering there needs to be. So that's why we're saying learn that lesson, invest in health systems, build up a basic healthcare system in each of these countries. And that not protective suits, not vaccines, not reforming the humanitarian system. That is the key lesson from this crisis.
Cox says universal health coverage would allow diseases to be identified, contained, and treated early.
People will be going for routine immunizations. People will be going to give birth. Mortality rates will come down.
Weak healthcare systems, he says, contribute to the deaths of 17,000 children each day from preventable causes such as malaria and pneumonia. The World Health Organization estimates it would cost a country nearly $90 per person per year to provide the minimum of health care. The Save the Children report recommends countries increase their domestic tax revenue so they can allocate at least 15% of their national budgets to health. It also calls on world leaders to commit to end preventable maternal, newborn, and child deaths by 2030. The organization says this and universal health coverage could be addressed in the Sustainable Development Goals that will replace the Millennium Development Goals at the end of this year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The annual Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, the largest event of its kind in the world, kicked off Saturday with a downtown parade featuring trail riders from all over Texas and even as far as the Mexican border region. The trail riders are themselves part of a tradition that dates back to 1952. VOA's Greg Flakes reports the tradition remains strong, even though Houston's urban area has grown much larger.
Every year, the Houston rodeo season begins with a parade downtown. The riders brave highways and city streets to get here. Tim Bronado came in with a group from a rural area north of the city.
It's getting harder every year for us just to find stops, to be able to stop safely and be safely on the side of the roads, to have our brakes stop.
But these trail riders don't sleep on the cold, hard ground the way old-time cowboys did. Rancher James Money rode in from Booth, Texas, about 45 kilometers away, and slept every night along the way in a comfortable camp trailer.
I don't know if we're as hard as the old-timers. You know, we have to have luxuries to be able to do it.
The day before the parade, riders make their last camp in Houston's Memorial Park. Here they can relax and practice their cowboy skills.
Congratulations on an outstanding trail ride.
There's also an award ceremony. Among the spectators was a visitor from Germany, Charula Palwitz.
It's very nice to see a little bit of the culture here and get a little bit of the mood here of Texas.
The big winner at the award ceremony was the Texas Independence Trail Ride from Brazoria, Texas. Joey Bolaños is among the proud winners.
It's like the best of the best. Organization, the horsemanship, and safety and all that.
Tradition is the most important element of the trail ride for rancher Ed Coes.
It's part of my heritage. My daddy was a rancher and farmer. His daddy was a rancher and farmer. We all were at one time in this Houston area. So we got to keep this going.
Most trail riders are not ranchers, but they need to tend to their animals year-round. 10-year-old Kevin says he does that work at home, although his little sisters disagree.
He don't ride his horses at home. He don't do hardly nothing at home with his horses.
I do.
The Barn Bunch riders even bring along their own specially designed fire barrel for the cold nights. The boss of the crew, Daphne Johnson, says the week-long ride can be tiring.
By Wednesday, everybody's saying, oh my gosh, I can't wait until this is over. By the time we get to the park, we're saying, oh no, the trail is almost over. And then on Sunday, we're planning for next year.
Johnson says she enjoys spending time every year with others who enjoy a taste of cowboy life. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You'll get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also listen to our program again. Go to the Programs tab and scroll on down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.